Mr. Thompson calls the waiter, orders steak and baked potato. He leaves the bone and gristle, and he never eats the skin. The busboy comes and takes it, with a cough contaminates it. He puts it in a can with coffee grounds and sardine tins. And the truck comes by on Friday, carts it all away. 1,000 trucks just like it are converging on the bay. Oh, garbage, 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 garbage.
Yes, it's every other Sunday again, and I'm Ronnie Lipschitz. You're listening to Sustainability Now, a radio show focused on environment, sustainability, and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. My guest today is Kevin Bell, co-founder and co-director of the Sustainable Systems Research Foundation in Santa Cruz, which is not coincidentally also the underwriter for this program. He holds an MPA from the Kennedy School at Harvard University and has over 35 years of deep experience in the areas of low-income advocacy, energy efficiency program design, education, and sustainable infrastructure in the public, private, entrepreneurial, academic, and nonprofit sectors. Bell has recently been conducting research into the plastics recycling dilemma and the diffusion of plastic throughout the environment. As you may have read in a number of places, not only is the ocean full of plastic, we are literally living in an ocean of plastic microparticles falling from the sky. Before you know it, we'll all be plastic people of the universe. So Kevin, welcome to Sustainability Now.
Thanks for inviting me.
I suspect most of our listeners are attuned to the plastics recycling dilemma that arose a few years ago as a result of China's national SWORD program. Can you explain what that is and the impacts on plastic recycling in the United States?
Sure. Two things have happened. One, and this is a pattern that we've seen in other commodity materials in the past. One is that if you have a developing country that doesn't have a lot of the advanced infrastructure for materials, or it's really expensive, or they don't have the raw materials, one of the things that those countries will do is take scrap materials from other countries that allow them to get their hands on those materials. So one of the causes of World War II was that Japan relied heavily on scrap steel from the United States, and the United States cutting that off was seen as an economic threat. In the case of China, they are making things out of plastic. They didn't have a lot of plastic production facilities. They didn't have a big domestic market that was generating those plastics as scrap. And so they saw it as being to their advantage, as other developing countries have, to take scrap plastic from Europe and from the United States mostly, and recycle the plastics that they could use. And they were helped by the fact that nobody was really checking to see what happened to all of the plastic that they got. And so typically what would happen is you would have these low-tech operations, literally family operations with kids picking through trash. There's an excellent documentary about this called Plastic China that I urge you to track down. And then burning whatever they couldn't use. And what a lot of the smaller operations especially were doing was taking plastic that they weren't really going to a lot of trouble to separate the plastic out. And so a lot of plastics, like plastic bottles that we think of as being high quality plastic because you make them into plastic bottles, didn't end up in plastic bottles at all. They would blend plastics together, and the recyclers were happy with that because it meant they could send a lot of plastics that we don't really recycle in the United States at all, ever, to China. China would turn it into a low-grade kind of plastic, and it would end up in cheap toys or playground material, just like stuff where it's only going to get used once, and then it's going to go to landfill or get it burned. And so basically, even if there was high-grade plastic in that mix, it would get turned into low-grade plastic. And a couple things happened with China. One was that they started to have a consumer market. They started to build their capacity to produce virgin plastic. When oil prices are low, recycling plastic doesn't really pencil out very well. But I think part of what happened in China, there's some evidence that part of what happened was politically, The idea that you are a trash colony for the world started to become something that was politically unacceptable. And so what happened with National Sword was, a couple of years ago, China said, you're sending us all of your trash. We're not interested in it anymore. We're not going to accept it anymore. And to the extent that China does accept it, and they do a little bit, they accept it to the same standards that high quality recycled plastics recyclers do in the United States or in Europe, which is it's there's no contaminants. When I say that I'm getting soda, when you say you're sending soda bottles, that's all that's in there. There's no other contaminants. And basically, no, we're not going to be your trash colony anymore. At the time, China was the largest, basically the biggest way that recyclers in Europe and the United States were supposedly recycling their plastic. So basically, what that meant was that the market basically evaporated. There have been some attempts in both the United States and Europe to convince countries like Malaysia or Vietnam that they should take the same deal that China took before National Sword. Those countries are less and less enthusiastic about doing it because they're recognizing that it's not really worth their time and they politically don't want to feel like they're being treated as a trash colony. The effect in the United States was that it basically ripped the happy face off of recycling in plastics. Up to that time, municipal governments and private companies that were doing plastics recycling and the plastics industry that is making plastic could say, look, it's fine. It all gets recycled and it turns back into things that you use. That's not actually true. We can get into that later. But basically, that whole narrative was basically built on a lie. And what China did was put an end to that lie. And as a result, what you're seeing is recycling programs in trouble all over the United States. Recycling programs are shut down. Independent recycling centers where you can supposedly take your bottles and cans and they give it to someone who's going to recycle it have shut down all over the country. Where recycling operations are still going, they're operating at a loss or they've dramatically restricted the types of plastic they'll take. And typically what that means is they'll take soda bottles and everything else goes to landfill. So basically what it's led to is pretty much the collapse of plastics recycling in the United States, except for some very limited circumstances.
So one thing that I've always that I've noticed is that sometimes we're asked to recycle plastics on the basis of the number that is imprinted on the material. And I think, you know, there's something like 10 different categories or something like that.
Including an other category.
Yeah, and you know, it's hard to figure out what's the difference between them. So maybe you can tell us and why some are recyclable and others not.
Okay.
And what are the differences?
Well, so basically what a plastic is a polymer. So it's a specific molecular form. And depending on what you used to make it out of, oil, gas, you can make it out of biological sources if you want to. And you can make things that look just like the stuff you made from oil or gas, natural gas, out of biological sources if you really want to. So there's this family of hundreds of different variants of polymers that you can make, and they each have different characteristics. And some of them, you can actually, like polystyrene, you can actually melt it back down into a resin that looks exactly like if you were making that resin for the first time. The problem with that is it's an industrial process, it's expensive. And ironically, the problem with styrofoam is not that the polystyrene isn't recyclable, it's that you have this huge light material that gets everywhere and is almost impossible to process. There are other ones, polyethylene, polypropylene, that again, typically come from oil and gas resources. They are more brittle or less brittle. They are more likely or less likely to break down in sunlight or under different kinds of circumstances. They handle, they kind of retain their original form more or less. They give off toxics more or less. You can add halogens like chlorine or fluorine or bromine to some of those plastics to make them a little more durable, but then they're more toxic. So basically, when plastics first took off in a big way in around 1970 or so, right around Earth Day, ironically, there was a lot of pressure on, there was a lot of pushback on the plastics industry because they people saw that they're unleashing this flood of new materials into the market with all these different characteristics that were going to end up in landfill or in the environment. And what typically happens in a situation like that is the industry will figure out what they need to do to deflect that criticism. And in the case of the plastics industry, what they said was, okay, so what we'll do is we'll make everybody put this little standard tag on all of the plastic stuff that's out there. And that'll make it easy for anybody to who wants to recycle this stuff to identify it. Because they can say, okay, it's number one. So number one is polyethylene, high density polyethylene. It's high density polyethylene. And we use that for soda bottles. So if you see number one, you know that we'll throw it into it, we'll throw it into a number one bin or somebody's sorting through it'll look at it and see that it's something that can be recycled and turned into bottles again. And there'll be a number one bin. So the idea is that you go to a recycling facility and there's all these bins with all these different types of plastic and all these different types of plastics get treated all these different kinds of ways and we're good. And the problem with that is that we're not just talking, there's the characteristics of the plastic are not only a function of kind of broad molecular structure of the plastic, they're also a function of one or more of the 2,000 or so things that you can add to the plastic. So it'll melt at a higher or lower temperature. So it'll be more or less brittle. So you can put it in a mold or you can blow it into a bottle. So it's stiff, so it's flexible. And so even within those different types, if you just have a big bin of number five plastic, it's generic plastic. And if you mix together something that has a bunch of different additives, you're going to have a number five recycled product that you can't use for the original thing that that the recycled materials were made for and made of. So if you look at, for example, Coca-Cola and Nestle's have some initiatives for recycled content in their soda bottles. And they're committing to something like 30% recycled content. And in order to do that, they have to be able to work with recycling centers that have the technology or infrastructure to make sure that the only plastic bottle material that they're getting out of all the different kinds with different additives and different uses that Coca-Cola or Nestle's is getting to blend with virgin plastic, that those specific bottles to a specific that have been manufactured to a specific standard with known additives, that's their feedstock. And they're essentially ignoring all of the other number one plastics. So it started out basically as a way to deflect criticism of the industry by saying, no, really, we can recycle a lot of this stuff. And it never really worked. And it and since a lot of those eight kinds of plastic aren't considered recyclable now, it's kind of a moot point. Let me give you an example. There's, you can go to the store or a deli and you get number one or number two plastic little deli containers, these clear containers that have a salad or your sandwich in them. And you look at your soda bottle and it says it's number one plastic. The additives in the deli container make it so that it's a little stiffer and so that it melts at a lower temperature so you can manufacture these things in a vacuum mold. The ones that are in the soda bottle melt at a higher temperature, and they're designed so you can take little miniature blanks, little miniature water bottles or soda bottles, and blow them like you're glass blowing to expand out into a bottle. If you mix the two, then it's not really suitable for either deli containers or for soda bottles. And so you have a recycled number one product that's going to go to something, some low grade use. It's going to get downgraded as a material. And probably after it goes through another cycle, it's going to end up in landfill or an incinerator. So it hasn't really worked as a solution.
Well, let's take a break here. You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and KSQD.org streaming on the internet. This is Ronnie Lipschitz. You're listening to Sustainability Now. My guest today is Kevin Bell, co-founder and co-director of the Sustainable Systems Research Foundation in Santa Cruz. And we're talking about plastics. We're talking about the chemistry of plastics, recyclability, and eventually about what decomposes and what doesn't. So my question is, do plastic materials decompose or are they really forever?
It depends on what you mean by decompose. And so there's basically two ways to think about it. One is that as it gets exposed to environmental degradation or sunlight, wind, rain, getting buried, whatever, it'll break down mechanically. And what that means is that some of the molecular bonds break down and it starts to fall apart into smaller pieces of plastic. And so it takes a very long time for that to happen, but what it doesn't get metabolized or broken down back into individual molecules of things that are not plastic. That is the atoms and molecules that were combined to make the plastic. And so it'll break down over a period of time and it'll sink to the bottom of the ocean, it'll float to the bottom of the ocean, it'll be in the landscape, or it'll be in the landfill. In a landfill, it's going to tend to be very stable. By definition, if you're doing your landfill right, stuff does not break down. Food doesn't break down, paper doesn't break down, plastic doesn't break down, it just sits there. But it breaks down into smaller and smaller pieces, and at some point, it gets down to sizes around, let's say, an inch or so. And or maybe between a quarter inch and an inch, and it's called a microplastic. So it's basically little pieces of plastic. And I've been involved in some beach surveys, and when you go out there, what you're looking for is stuff that's intact, and then you're trying to identify these littler pieces of plastic that are mechanically broken down. They're still plastic. As they break down further into stuff that's down below a millimeter or so, you're getting into a level that's called nanoplastics, so very small pieces of plastic. And you start running into another problem, which is that you not only have this stuff around, but when it's small enough, then it starts to interact with plants and animals and other organisms who are not breaking it down into anything plastic. It's still plastic. But because of some of the things that are in that plastic, let's say it's a polyvinyl chloride, which is a chlorinated plastic. Chlorine is toxic in any form. And so you start to get some of the molecular characteristics of these tiny particles of plastic that are small enough that they're starting to be inside these organisms. You're starting to have them disrupt endocrine patterns or chemical or body processes in those organisms. But it's still plastic. It doesn't really break down for our purposes ever. It just gets smaller, turns into smaller and smaller bits of plastic and eventually gets incorporated into something else. My favorite right now is there's a term that's really popular right now describing what's happened with climate. We talk about the Anthropocene as a geological era that's defined as a geology where you can see the impacts of humans in the geology that we're going to be, that somebody would be looking at 50 million years from now. And there's actually one of those markers is composite plastic and rock minerals, where you can identify the plastic component. And essentially that's going to be there forever.
I suppose that, when in the future, when archaeologists are mining sites, they'll come into layers of this stuff, right?
That's exactly right.
Plastics, yeah.
That's exactly right. I have a colleague who was in Hawaii and where some of the first examples of these Anthropocene rocks are starting to appear. It's a composite sample from beach parties where the plastic is fused with sand to form a stable rock. But the way that you want this to work, and if we're going to keep using plastics, where a lot of what we do has to move towards, is biodegradable. And there's an important distinction there, because, and we can talk about this more if you want, but there's a lot of confusion in describing how plastics break down. It's kind of like the confusion about whether they recycle or not. And a lot of people are happy to have there be a lot of confusion. You will hear things about degradable plastics, which is essentially that they rapidly break down into nanoplastics. It's not that they go away. You hear about bio-based plastics, which are plastics derived from biological sources, which may or may not degrade or biodegrade.
Let's get back to that in a minute, because okay. I wanted to go back. Yeah.
But the other thing I want to say is, just quickly, there are plastics that biodegrade, which means they break down into atomic and molecular level materials where there is no trace of the original plastic piece that they started from.
Well, I want to come back and talk about those, right, and about the project. But going back to the biological questions, right, we ingest this stuff, presumably, right? And it doesn't go straight through. It ends up in our, circulating and in organs and bloodstreams. I'm sort of wondering about, because you mentioned that, in some organisms, that's what happens. Does the stuff end up being incorporated in our, organs and so on, or is it just going straight through?
We all have little bits of plastic in us, and the state of the science on what that means is not good. A lot of the work that's been done on the biological impact of nanoplastics has been at the bottom end of the food chain. So we're talking about marine microorganisms and kind of working up through crustaceans. The evidence there is not pretty. We don't have enough information about the impact on mammals and humans at this point. There are some variants that have, basically, we know that if you've got something that's a chlorinated compound like chlorine, there's going to be a health risk. We know that some materials act as endocrine disruptors, and there's some evidence that that's happening with humans too, but we don't definitively know yet.
That's interesting. And just one more question about that, right? I mentioned this research that was done in, I guess it was done in national parks, and discovered that, I guess, nanoplastics or ultra nanoplastics are raining down out of the atmosphere. And how do they get up there?
They turned into microplastics and continued breaking down, and got small enough that they got picked up by the atmosphere and got moved around.
Where are they coming from? Do you know?
All the plastic that's sitting out in the environment. Since the beginning of the 20th century, we've produced about 1 ton of plastic for every person who's alive today. And of that, this is as of about 3 years ago, which is a great definitive study that was done about this. Of that, about a quarter of it is in the environment. And less than 1% of it is circulating and recycling.
Well, it'd be quite a challenge, given our dependence on it.
Right. And one thing that I just want to say briefly, and we can circle back later if you want. Yeah. There's a particularly pernicious industry response to the concern about plastics called oxo-degradable plastics. And what these are is they'll take a biodegradable plastic, that one that does break down, and use that as a matrix for nanoparticle scale conventional plastics. And so you throw it on the ground and it disappears visually. So they say it's gone. So this is our solution. But what you've done is basically just produced a bunch of instant nanoparticles that add to that problem of nanoplastics in the world. And it's actually being, Europe has finally, after a really concerted industry effort, has finally said no to oxo-degradable plastics. The United States has not said no yet.
I want to come back to that after our next break, but I just want to mention I have this New Yorker cartoon somewhere. A man is standing in front of another about to be decapitated by a guillotine, and he asks the victim, paper or plastic? So what's the answer?
That is a really interesting question. For me, clearly it's paper, because paper does biodegrade. Not landfill, but it does biodegrade. Basically, the 70s is also when you started to see paper bags, which is what everybody used, be replaced by plastic bags. And there was this huge surge of industry-sponsored research that said, well, you know, if you look at the environmental cost of cutting down trees and turning them into paper and all the chemicals that go into making paper and then getting rid of the paper, and it's heavier than plastic, so it uses more fuel moving stuff around, then plastic is better. And it's a great example of what happens when you divorce thinking about environmental issues from thinking in terms of the systems. Because if the focus is on which one, does it cost less energy to make a plastic bag or a paper bag? Plastic bags win. If you look at the environmental cost of having a quarter ton of plastic per person in the environment, a lot of it in the form of plastic bags blowing all over everywhere with all that that implies, it's no contest. How do you put a price on that? And because you can't put a price on that, really, and people try, but it's really difficult to do. Basically, the implicit assumption when you can't figure out how to put a price on something like covering the earth with plastic bags is that the price is zero. And so those kinds of analyses, that's basically that's basically how they work out. And you can see some very good studies today saying, well, disposable plastic bag versus a reusable bag made out of plastic fiber. And actually, if you're looking at it from an energy point of view, disposable plastic bags are better if you're not counting all of those other back-end impacts.
Well, let's take a break, okay? You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz on your radio dial and KSQD.org streaming on the internet. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Sustainability Now on KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz. This is Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Kevin Bell, co-founder and co-director of the Sustainable Systems Research Foundation in Santa Cruz. And we're talking about the work he's been doing recently, studying the compostability, actually, of various kinds of plastics. Kevin, you were talking earlier about biodegradable plastics. And maybe you can say some more again about, you know, what actually is going on when that term biodegradable or even compostable is attached to the term plastic.
So what biodegradable means is that the plastic will sooner or later break down into its component molecules. So you won't, its component to molecular compounds that have no trace of the original plastic molecules. So the polymers physically break down into stuff that's in the natural environment as a biological material that gets, you know, that gets turned into trees and animals and everything else. It goes back basically to the source atoms and environmental molecules that you would expect to see. There's no trace of the original plastic material. And again, there's the industry talks about bioplastics. Not all bioplastics are biodegradable. They're bio-based. I can make plastic for a soda bottle out of trees if I really want to take the time and money to do that. So bio-based does not mean, and so when you talk about bioplastics, bio-based bioplastic is not biodegradable. If you mix fossil fuel derived or bio derived non biodegradable plastics with biodegradable plastics, then you get oxodegradable plastics. So they talk about degradable bioplastics. They're not talking about biodegradable bioplastics. And the industry, manufacturers, distributors are really squirrely when you try and dig into what exactly the stuff is. It's always important to be very precise. So by the time we get down to biodegradable, there's really kind of two, there's basically two classes of plastic that we're talking about. You can make them from fossil fuel sources, but generally you don't. And so when we talk about biodegradable plastics, typically what we're talking about is in one of two broad families. And one of them is polylactic acid, which is known as PLA. And the other one is, let me make sure I get the pronunciation right, polyhydroxyalkanoate, or PHA. And within those two families, again, what's the source material? How'd you process it? What are you trying to turn the plastic molecule into? Whether it's, are you going to add additives to it? I think we're going to see a scandal in a few years where you've got biodegradable plastics where somebody added some terrible additives to it that don't biodegrade. But the idea with both of those, and they're, PLA is the one that is kind of dominating now in the world of biodegradable plastics, as I can talk about a little bit if you want. It's not really biodegradable the way that you and I typically think about it, but it does eventually break down. But basically within each family, you've got all these different characteristics. Both of them, you can make all different kinds of plastic. You can make milk bottles, you can make stock, you can make beer cups, you can make whatever else you want to make that we make plastic out of today. And the difference is that sooner or later, it'll start to fall apart, and sooner or later it will disappear as a plastic. And the story of PLA is really interesting because if you look at just how many, if you look at bioplastics for starters, a lot of what's described as bioplastics is and you'll see this again in a lot of industry stuff where you kind of dig in, where it says it's bioplastic. Really what it is conventional plastic, where the source material for making that plastic was biological sources. You made it out of sawdust or something. And then there's a subset of bioplastics that are biodegradable, and that's generally either PLA or PHA. PLA is made by fermenting starch. And the starch typically comes from a commodity crop like corn. And there's been some great work that's been done saying, well, if you're doing industrialized farming corn from the Midwest, and you look at the environmental footprint of doing that to make the starch to make PLA, are you really better off in terms of environmental footprint? And the answer is it's kind of a push. So the source of this stuff for PLA actually matters. The bigger problem is on the back end that the way it's breaking down biologically is that you've got microorganisms that are eating this stuff and processing it and turning it into to molecules that you would typically find in the environment. In the case of PLA, those organisms are rare, and it's really more like a degradation process. It does break down into non-plastic materials, unlike all these other plastics we've been talking about. But it's not something where stuff is eating it and it falls apart and we're done. And one of the, it turns out that if you look closely at what the certifications that are out there for these materials are, PLA is described as a industrially compostable material. And what that means is that if you let it sit in the presence of some organisms that can actually deal with the stuff, and again, they're rare, but they exist, at 160 degrees for several months, then it'll break down. If you throw it in the ocean, if you throw some PLA in the ocean along with a plastic bottle, go back after 2 years, it'll still be there. If you throw it into your home composting, it'll pretty much still be there. If you put it in, and industrial composting, there are people, again, it is a high-tech process. It's expensive. Not many places do it, including a lot of commercial and municipal composting operations. So, for example, in the Monterey Bay area, we have a the only composting operation we have is down at Marina Landfill, and it's a digester. And they do not consider PLA recyclable. They consider it a contaminant because they can run it through 4, 5, 6 times, and it doesn't go away. So what they end up doing basically is separating it out, and it goes to landfill. So technically, it is biodegradable. In practice, it's not. And the reason why it is popular, you know, why it was kind of became the industry alternative, was because you basically it's a way to use up corn or cassava or whatever your favorite starch source is. One of the things that I'm intrigued about, but I really haven't been able to dig into, is the question of, you see a lot of PLA coming out of Asia, where the source is sugarcane bagasse, which is the fiber, so the fiber and leftover sugars from making sugar from sugarcane. If you are going to use PLA, then maybe you want to source something where it's not just a niche. You're going to make a lot of whatever the source material is, but it is a waste product, which sugarcane bagasse is. So does that mean that sugarcane-based PLA is better than corn PLA, corn-based PLA? My instinct is yes, but I don't really know. I mean, there's a lot more. I'd have to do a lot more work on that to see if there's better or worse types of PLA. In general, though, it's not really the right answer. What you want is something that is produced by biological process, and that breaks down completely biologically. That's what PHA is. It turns out that if you grow a bunch of bacteria and deprive it of some minerals or deprive it of oxygen, then it'll start storing energy, and it'll store energy in these little nodules that are a polymer. And so you just extract that. You can make PHA from all kinds of things. You can make it from compost. You can make it from starch if you want, but you can make it from pretty much anything. And what you're making the plastic out of is bacteria food. So when you throw it back on the ground, It's bacteria food. It gets eaten by the bacteria and it disappears, and it disappears quickly. So you can make high temperature PHAs, low temperature PHAs, brittle, flexible. Haven't really been able to dig into the issue of additives for biodegradable plastics, but assuming that we're doing this right, it's a great answer. Something like 40% of the plastic demand in the world is for single-use items, stuff that we're just going to throw away. And those plastics tend to be the ones that end up in the environment. So when I'm looking at solutions, I think that plastics have based, that recycling plastics have generally failed, with some exceptions. And we need to be moving towards, instead of talking about reduce, reuse, recycle, I think we need to be talking about reduce, reuse, compost, recycle, and either be using fiber products, paper plates, bamboo plates. There's another issue with some of those products because some of them are sprayed with toxics. You got to make sure that those aren't the ones you're using. But generally, I think that PHA is the solution for applications where it's appropriate to be using single-use or short-lived plastics because it comes from a biological source. We've actually been talking to a company that uses compost, residential and commercial compost, as its feedstock for making this stuff. So gives you this great option of having compostable plastic made of compost, which I like a lot. It's the closest we can get in a plastic, I think, to having it be a true circular process where it just goes over and over again. It doesn't degrade. It just and you can sustain that process for as long as you want.
Well, as
Yeah, go ahead.
Let me just, you know, I want to just raise an issue here, which is, of course, we've got this enormous industry, which is technologically committed to particular kinds of materials, feedstocks and products, right? I mean, raw materials to make the products. It's a bit like the steel industry in the United States, which I think was using Bessemer, right? The Bessemer process. And after World War II, Japan, which had been thoroughly destroyed, started to deploy electric furnaces to make steel, right? Whereas the Bessemer furnaces became obsolete, and instead of replacing them, companies shut down. So there's this whole kind of, you know, supply chain issue with the industry. Do you think the plastics industry could be convinced to retool to produce, you know, plastics from PHA?
Well,
PHA plastics.
This is a really serious problem. It's actually worse than that, because the oil industry is looking for how it's going to make the transition to a post-carbon world. And if you look at, you can go online and find some very detailed and well-researched long-range scenarios and plans. BP and Shell are actually two of the better ones for that. The plans are ludicrous because they're not going to work, but they have been pretty well, but it does give you some insight into kind of where they're thinking their money is coming from, because they plan on being around and still being dominant in 50 years. And what they talk about doing is basically shifting from producing fuel to producing more plastic. In fact, they talk in terms of tripling the percentage of oil. They're still producing the same amount of oil, but they're basically tripling the amount of oil that is going to make plastics. And it goes from being, right now it's maybe 6 or 7% of the gas and oil feedstocks going to making plastic. And so if you look at their scenarios for 50 years from now, they're digging maybe half as much oil and gas out of the ground, of which a third of it is going to make plastics, more plastics. So it's not just that we've got this embedded infrastructure around plastic. It's that the oil industry believes that their strategic path to long-term prosperity involves massively upsizing their plastics production.
Yeah. Well, let's take a break. Okay. And we'll come back and we'll finish our discussion. You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and KSQD.org, streaming on the internet. We'll be back in a moment. This is Sustainability Now, and I'm Ronnie Lipschitz on KSQD FM. My guest today is Kevin Bell, the co-founder and co-director of the Sustainable Systems Research Foundation in Santa Cruz. And we've been talking about plastics and chemistry and compostability and all kinds of things. So Kevin, what's the point of all of this research?
The point is that we have a huge and growing problem, and the default arc of this is that it's going to get much, much worse. We're talking about tripling the amount of plastic in the ocean over the next 20 years. We're talking about the oil industry, global oil industry, tripling production of plastic materials that do not break down. And there's a couple of things that have happened, a couple of unfortunate cultural things that happened. One of them is, and this is, I think, another dodge that we see in a lot of areas, when we have an extreme sustainability issue like plastics, the first tendency is to say, well, we gave you a way to deal with this. We put numbers on the plastic. We told you to recycle stuff. And so it's your individual responsibility to do those things, because because we're kind of in a culture that's around individual responsibility, the fact that you wouldn't have to be dealing with that if tens of thousands of different plastics with thousands of different additives and all kinds of way end use paths and impacts are coming at you, standing there with something in your hand and 3 seconds to decide if it goes into landfill or recycling. There's a tendency to say, well, it's happening. It's China's fault because they're not taking our stuff anymore. It's your fault because you didn't read the really confusing sign on the recycling bin to find out if this thing in your hand is actually recycled or not. It depends. Usually it's going to go to landfill these days. What I tend to do is try and figure out where are the points where you can intervene in a system that's broken to leverage a better outcome. And I think the better outcome in this case is who gave you this thing in your hand that you have in your hand right now. If we can change the stuff that that a restaurant or a store or a somebody's making shampoo is choosing, not because they get better points in their public image that way, but because it's available and it has all these advantages and you're committed to actually trying to do something about the problem, that's a more effective way to intervene in this problem and actually shift it to a better outcome. And so Sustainable Systems Research Foundation doesn't try and change the world. We try and come up with solutions that we could replicate and scale in other places. And we try and find a place where you can intervene, where you could have a big impact. So public education programs to make you feel guilty because you didn't do the right thing or you didn't know. I'm kind of offended by those because that's not where the responsibility lies. I think the responsibility lies in having stores and restaurants be able to order things from distributors that are better for us environmentally and more sustainable. And so what we set out to do was to try and figure out what those things are. And it turns out to be a morass. That with PHA is a trivial fraction of plastic that you can get commercially right now. And where you can get it, it's in Europe or Asia. It's not really in the United States. There was a company in the United States that was selling it commercially, plastic film like Saran Wrap. And it got bought by, I believe it was Cargill, and vanished. So now there's the first large scale PHA manufacturing plant in the country is supposedly opening up later this year on the East Coast. You know, don't know how much it'll get delayed now, but let's say it just opens the next few months. Its production capacity is trivial. So, my goal basically is for this 40% of plastics that is being produced and thrown away right away to come up with alternatives to that involve things that you reuse or where you're using something that we already know is going to break down, like paper like paper, cardboard, stuff like that, that hasn't been coated with Teflon or some other toxic substance. There's a whole other thread that goes with that. And where plastics are the right answer, this new round of materials that's coming up. One of the things that's driving us in the next few years is that Europe is doing a very good job relative to the rest of the world on requiring those genuinely biodegradable plastics. And I think that, and if you look, there's a huge amount of kind of excitement and startups that are kind of trying to, and different solutions that are kind of jostling to be first in line in this market that's going to grow really fast. I thought that these materials were more widely available commercially than they turned out to be. But what we have been able to do is identify alternatives now. We've learned a lot about being able to identify materials that actually do what we want them to do as opposed to ones that are advertised as doing what we want them to do. And because we've had to kind of work up the food chain, we thought we could be talking to distributors and stores and restaurants and having stores and restaurants and institutions to be specifying the materials that we know are the right answer. And we're going to do that, but we're actually ending up talking directly to manufacturers that are starting to build commercial plants because that gets us access to those materials a lot more quickly. So the goal is that we help to, you know, starting on a regional scale, Monterey Bay is maybe 1 million people, so big enough to matter, small enough that we're not trying to save the entire country or the entire planet. We're not waiting for federal legislation to make it all better. We're not waiting for the United States to get around to doing what Europe's been doing for about 5 years now to get to starting to do some good regulation. We can start to move the market. We can start to move what's considered best practice or acceptable practice. And we can do it with something where if we can get it to work in Monterey Bay, we can do it in a lot of places. And part of this, you know, the back end of this is, if we're going to have compostable packaging, we need to have a composting program. There are places in the country and around the world that do that and do it effectively. Those places are generally not in the state of California. And so part of this is, if you've created a constituency of people who order this stuff, so that the people who are using this stuff have some good choices to make, you now have a constituency of users and people that are the ones that are making those material choices for users, going to state and local governments saying, so for this to work, you guys need to be doing composting. There's lots of different types of composting, and some of them don't compost, biodegradable plastic and paper or cardboard containers. And so you're also starting to put pressure on local governments and companies that are building these composting facilities to make composting infrastructure that's going to actually allow us to have a sustainable cycle for how we use disposable materials. So that's the goal, and it's a long-term goal. But we can, on a scale of a 3-county area with 1 million people in it, making significant progress over 3 to 5 years is doable. Starting a local campaign to do federal legislation in the United States to actually pay attention to this and say no to the fossil fuel industry, not going to happen. So
I wanted to ask, we're almost out of time, and I wanted to play devil's advocate briefly, which is really about, you know, this is a market-oriented solution as opposed to the legislative and regulatory one, presumably in Europe. Mm-hmm. And, you know, really the question is, how do you make that jump from trying to affect the market to actually, you know, legislating? I mean, it's a bit like the plastic bag ban, right? That it only really became effective when there was legislation that provided disincentives to plastic bags.
Right, and I guess my answer to that is two things. One is that policymakers a lot of times don't have the time or more often won't take the time to really dig into the things they're being told and some of the details. And you end up with some bad policies when you do that. Simply banning plastic bags, which a lot of countries around the world, especially developing countries, have done as an act of desperation because they're completely overwhelmed. Washington State, give you an example, the city of Seattle and a bunch of other cities around the United States banned plastic straws started banning plastic straws. And the plastics industry ran an initiative in the state of Washington that made it illegal for cities to ban plastic straws. Ran a very sophisticated marketing campaign. The initial polling was 2-1 against the initiative, and the initiative eventually won. So policy is imperfect absent a better way to do it being accepted as a better way to do it. And so I think part of what we're trying to do, eventually, yeah, I think you do get to legislation or policies and bans. But the only way you get to that is to be able to say, look, we're already doing this. It works. Why are we still doing it this other way? Because we know the damage that doing it the way we've been doing it. We know what those costs are. I think part of what you do by showing that there is a way to do this that is actually going to work better, it makes it much more difficult for industry or lazy policy people or politicians to claim that they don't have a choice. From slavery to plastic, basically, one of the arguments is always, yeah, it's kind of a drag, but we don't really have a choice. Or how about if we do this thing that looks like it solves the problem, like we're going to number all the plastics, but it doesn't really, but it looks like it does. And that gives us another 10, 20 years to kind of skate without actually having to look for a real solution. By making doing the right thing the thing that people expect, you make it much more difficult to hide when things like bans or better or policies that change, that fundamentally change how we do this, make it much harder to hide when somebody's trying to fight making the right thing happen.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time, but I want to thank you, Kevin, for being on Sustainability Now. You can find out more information about plastics recycling and compostability at the website of the Sustainable Systems Research Foundation, and the URL for that is sustainablesystemsfoundation.org. In 2 weeks, on January 10th, 2021, my guest will be Jeffrey Downing, professor of art at San Francisco State University, who was featured a few weeks ago in the San Francisco Chronicle for his environmental sculpture in Richardson Bay. That's Sunday, January 10th, 5 to 6 p.m., right here on KSQID 90.7 FM and ksquid.org on the internet. Remember, shows from this Sunday slot are rebroadcast the following Tuesday morning from 6 to 7 a.m., and you can hear previous shows on ksqd.org/sustainabilitynow. Thanks for listening, and thanks to Emily Dunham for today's engineering and to everyone else at the station who makes KSQID your community radio station. Until next every other Sunday, Sustainability Now.
Mr. Thompson calls the waiter, orders steak and baked potato. He leaves the bone and gristle, and he never eats the skin. The busboy comes and takes it, with a cough contaminates it. He puts it in a can with coffee grounds and sardine tins. And the truck comes by on Friday, carts it all away. 1,000 trucks just like it are converging on the bay. Oh, garbage, 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 garbage.